Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench.
Hello, welcome back to Fighting on Film. Now this week we're taking a little detour from the kind of movies that we do on the show and cover a film that we recently went to see a couple of weeks ago. We had a podcasting trip away at the IWM Duxford. And we caught a movie beforehand, and it's one me and Matt have wanted to see for a while now. It's called Zone of Interest, as you'll probably know if you've clicked on the title of this show. And it's an incredible film about the Holocaust, and it's one that is told very differently from a lot of other Holocaust movies that have been made to date. And this episode isn't going to have an alley tally. It's not going to have a favourite scenes. It's going to be a production and a cast rundown, and then me and Matt are just going to talk loosely about what we enjoyed about the movie, what its themes, things it does well, because it is very affecting, a very powerful film. So, Matt, would you like to do cast first, and then I'll do production?
Yeah, so I'm just going to cover the two leads, and the premise of the film essentially follows Rudolf Hess's family. He's the commandant of one of the Auschwitz camps, and later he's promoted, and of course. Just do a little reading on his background if you want to know the kind of heinous individual he actually truly was.
Horrible man.
And his wife, Hedwig. He's played by Christian Friedel, and you might know him from films such as 30 Minutes, the ongoing Babylon Berlin series, which began in 2017. And also, he's going to be in White Lotus later this year, apparently, interestingly. And Friedel had been quite reluctant to play Nazi roles. He'd been offered them in the past during his career, and he'd always avoided doing them. And the script and the material for Zone of Interest was such that he felt that it was something that he had to do. And in terms of likeness in casting, it's not always an essential thing.
No, I think, but.
It seems that Glazer kind of hit the nail on the head with this one, because there is a very striking kind of resemblance.
I mean, he's got that swept back haircut, you see.
He's been nominated for European Film Award as Best Actor, Astra Film Award, Best International Actor, and he won the Montclair Film Festival Breakthrough Performer Award for his performance in this film. And I'm sure there'll be further nominations that I've mentioned and awards that he's already won, because
it must be very hard to give an award because of the person you're portraying.
Must be very hard to receive it as well.
Yes, his performance is it's so nuanced and it's so subtle. Like, it's this movie is just amazing subtleness and hinting all the way through. But with Hearst, you never feel at any moment that he has any sort of remorse for what he's doing.
No. And that's very true. And then the other lead in the film is played by Sandra Hüller. And we've mentioned her on the show before. She appeared in Munich, Edge of War in 2021. She's had a long career in European film, very well known. Recently has had Oscar noms and Golden Globe nominations for Anatomy of a Fall, which came out last year. And then she's also been nominated at the BAFTAs for both Anatomy of a Fall and Zone of Interest. So performances which are being recognized by various, you know, award giving enterprises and entities and such, and they are, I think, justly deserved.
Much deserved.
Because the film is it's focused on them. We see their lives and how they react to their surroundings, and the interplay between them and the other supporting characters, all very much against the backdrop of the Holocaust, is
literally going on behind a wall.
When I say backdrop, it literally is the backdrop.
Feet away.
Yeah. They're very, very strong performances. And we'll talk about some of the nuances of those performances as we go on. So I know for a fact that this film had a very interesting kind of production. So Rob's going to run us through a couple of the elements of that.
Yeah, so production-wise, the film's directed by English director Jonathan Glazer. Yeah, he's probably best known for his films Sexy Beast, 2004 with Ray Winston, and Birth and Under the Skin that starred Scarlett Johansson. He hasn't done many films, but the films he has done have been quite critically acclaimed. Very well received. You know, I remember
an auteur kind of director.
Very auteur director, yes. I remember when Sexy Beast came out, it was like, this is a very different kind of gangster film than what we're used to. So much so that recently Sexy Beast has had a TV adaptation, that was so sort of cult and revered. The film itself is based upon the 2014 book of the same name by Martin Amis. He passed away very recently. I think he passed away the week of the initial screening. In 2023. The cinematography is by two-time Oscar-nominated Polish cinematographer Lukasz Zal. I'm probably butchering that, very sorry. His credits include Loving Vincent, Dovlatov, and I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Music was by BAFTA-winning Micah Levi. He's a British composer and songwriter. He's worked previously with Glazer on Under the Skin. He's also composed a soundtrack for Jackie, the film about Jackie Kennedy, which I would recommend. That's a great film. Marjorie Prime and Zola. The film was produced in association with Film 4, Access Industries and the Polish Film Institute. And it was distributed by A24. I don't think I've ever seen a bad A24 film, actually, thinking about it. They are a mark of quality, I think. Principal photography took place in Auschwitz in 2021 and lasted 55 days. The Hearst house was built converting a derelict house beyond the camp wall, and the flowers were planted months before, allowing them to bloom to give scenes colour and the backdrop of the grey wall that's around Auschwitz itself. The film does not show the atrocities face on, but rather through sound. A catalogue of events inside the camp was compiled by the film's sound designer, Johnny Byrne, that were then used to build a sound library over a year to be used within the film itself.
Incredible.
And Glazer has described the soundscape as the other film, arguably the film. The film's crew and director were not on set during filming. 10 cameras were embedded around the property, which allowed the actors to improvise and encourage them to block out scenes as they saw fit, Glazer calling it Big Brother in the Nazi House.
Wow.
And I've seen interviews with Hula saying about how you were just playing the scenes as you would play them naturally. There was no one there sort of stopping you or saying cut. It was they let a scene go on, and then maybe over a little speaker system, I think Glazer and the crew would say, right, can you just do that again for us? It was quite an unconventional way of filming it, but then this is a very unconventional film. So I think it really helps and enriches.
It's a very organic feel, I think.
Very organic.
In that they kind of live in that scene.
They do.
And they aren't in him, you know, inhibited by the presence of a crew milling around.
People move around a lot more naturally in this movie. They're not, I think we're a lot, I've acted in front of a camera and you're very aware that it's there and you do a lot of weird movements to sort of not look at it. But in this,
people, you get that thing where, you know, when we're recording a podcast, as soon as the red light goes on, you kind of, your mindset changes ever so slightly.
Yeah, agreed.
And when I did music production in, you know, college and stuff, like as soon as we put the red light on, then performers and people in the booth and stuff, it's like it changes, things change.
Yeah.
You tense up.
I think in the way of filming this gave the actors a real sense of freedom to tackle the scenes the way they wanted. And it definitely shows in the final cut. No lighting rigs were used, and the house's light was all natural, giving the film quite a modern.
The lighting in this is incredible.
It's such a great thing. Like, it's so good. Really, really good filmmaking. This is probably one of the most technically brilliant films I've seen in a long time.
Mm.
So Glazer worked closely with the Auschwitz Museum and used their archives to help create the movie. And the young Polish girl in the film, and we'll talk about her later, she's inspired by a real girl called Alexandra, who Glazer met during his research. She was a 12-year-old member of the Polish resistance, and she would cycle to the camp to leave apples for the prisoners overnight. And in the film, she discovered a piece of music written by a prisoner. The prisoner's name was Joseph Wolf. He survived the war. And Alex, I think that piece of that music is used in the movie. Alexandra was 90 years old when she met Glazer, and she died shortly after. But the bike that the girl uses in the movie and dress that the actress wore belonged to her.
Wow.
Incredible. Really, really incredible. And we'll talk about her sequences a bit later on, and I've got a little bit more on that when we do. But the budget was reportedly a $15 million film. Not very much at all. You wouldn't know it looking at it. And at the time of recording, it's earned back $12.5 million. And it's been nominated for over 150 award nominations this award season. Matt mentioned some for acting. But it's got 5 Oscar nominations so far. And it's up for 5 Oscars, including Best International Feature, Best Sound Directing Screenplay Adaptation for Glazer. And I think it could comfortably win all of those, personally. Mm. Yeah. I do think it will win quite a high number of those. And I think it's up for maybe 9 to 8 BAFTAs as well. So I think it's going to clean up, and it should, because this film is a technical masterpiece. And
it's a wonder that none of the cast were nominated, to be honest.
No, I mean,
it's difficult with a you know, a film like this in a packed kind of
a packed year with Oppenheimer, Barbie,
exactly.
The holdovers. I think it was quite a late thing for the holdovers to come out so late and then do as well as it's done. Mm. But this movie's come out late as well, general release, and it's showing why it's so revered. So that's all I have for production this week. So I think maybe we'll go into our thoughts.
So to jump off something you mentioned a moment ago, you mentioned, Rob, the lighting. And I was struck immediately because the film opens with that beautiful idyllic scene of a family on a picnic by a river, frolicking in grass, picking cherries or berries. And just that bright, idyllic summer sunlight.
Yeah.
Everything's
calm and normal. Yeah.
And you're immediately struck by that diegetic sound as well. So it's that you can hear the birds and the trees and the sand and the grass rustling and the water, the river, and it immediately creates this soundscape and visual landscape which captures your attention.
Yeah.
Fully.
But even before that, the film starts with a pitch black screen with no titles, and it has this hulking, loud, deafening soundscape of it's hard to, I'm gonna have to imitate it. It's like a a sort of, not an Inception level wham, you know, like that, but it's it's like monstrous. It's a monstrous sound. I think that's probably the best way to describe it.
It made me think of a machine.
I think that's right.
And I think the parallels with, the industrial scale of the Holocaust.
And that goes
immediately spring to me. But I think that's something you can interpret.
I think so. This film does a lot, and the film does a lot of that for the viewer to interpret and fill in the gaps. But that sequence at the very, very start with the sound and the pitch black screen, that maybe goes on for maybe 5 minutes, or it feels like it does.
It does go on an awfully long time. And it also, what struck me was it felt like almost like a palate cleanser. Going from the, obviously before you start a film, you've got all the trailers and the adverts, and turn off your phone, go and get some popcorn, jaunty little jingles and stuff. But this is a very serious subject. It felt to me like that was a way of blocking the film out from everything that had gone before it.
And you couldn't
sat through.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't hear a pin drop in the cinema. No one talked. I've been to cinemas lately, and people do chat more than they used to during movies, I think. Cinema etiquette has certainly died off a bit for me. But during this one, not at all. Like, we were transfixed on what was going on the screen in front of us. Like, it's so affecting.
Absolutely.
So affecting. So after that, the family gets to the house, and you're immediately aware that you are where you are. Because I think, viewers of this movie, I don't think you're going to see this movie on a whim. It's not that type of film.
No, you know what you're going for.
It's just this really uneasy feeling that you get all the way through it, where whatever's going on inside the house, you're horrifically aware of what's going on, yards behind it at any given time. And whether it's doing that through, you hear screams in the background, then you hear a gunshot, then you hear no screams anymore, or you see a puff of train smoke behind the house.
Yeah.
It's that great thing of showing and not telling and not show. Sorry, telling but not showing. But on this insane scale of, and I read a review, it was on TikTok actually, of a review, a young girl who'd reviewed the movie, and she said, this movie is affecting because we've seen the imagery. We've seen it a lot. You know, whether you've done history at Key Stage 9 and you've learned about the Holocaust, whether you've seen Schindler's List or any documentary about the Holocaust since, the imagery is horrible. It sticks with you, and it rightfully should stick with you. And your brain can fill in the gaps. And that's the horrific part of it, I think, for me. That's the affecting part of it, that we know exactly what's going on. Yeah. And the characters inside that house, they talk about it, but they don't talk about it in the way we talk about it.
No.
And that is the horrifying thing for me, is this family are fully 100% aware what's going on behind them. They just don't give a shit.
No, and we'll talk about some instances of that in a moment or two, but it's the mundane everyday stuff, like preparing food, washing the floor, turning lights out before you go to bed, shutting the doors, watering plants. They're living their entire life in the shadow of the Holocaust as it happens.
Yeah,
and there's a scene which, to me, was one of the most striking in the film, where Hedwig's mother comes to visit, and they haven't seen each other in a while. And she arrives at the camp after a long train journey, and they chat about that, and they're in the kitchen, and they're just mundane chit chat, just the dullest stuff. And then she takes her on a tour of the house, and you can see the mother's becoming more and more impressed. Oh, this is a lovely house. You're running things.
You've done so well for yourself.
You have help. Local help is coming. And then she goes out into the garden, and she's showing her the allotments and the little pool they've got, and the garden that she's designed. The mother's more and more impressed. And then there's some gunshots or shouting from the other side of the wall. That's the ever-present wall. And the mother says, do you remember such and such? I used to clean for him. I wonder if he's in here, or I wonder where he is now. Because he's a Jewish gentleman, Jewish family that she's worked for before the war, before Hitler came to power in the 30s. And Hedwig's visibly kind of uncomfortable about that. You know, she goes, I don't know, it doesn't matter. Carry on showing her the garden. And then the mother continues, she kind of persists with it a little bit, and she says, well, you know, when they were dragged out, like, I tried to buy his cairns, I bid for his cairns in the street auction. And someone else won them, and she was annoyed because she just missed out, you know. And that's it. It kind of pulled that person's life down to the element of missing out on something on eBay.
Their property. There's something something to be sort of just shunted away.
But it also adds to that. It's a fact of life. She talks about it in such mundane terms that that is very striking. And she continues by saying, she missed out on that. And Hedwig is so uncomfortable about this line of conversation, she deflects it again and leads her off into another part of the garden.
But I felt like it wasn't deflecting it to not talk about what the ins and outs of it.
No, so she wants to show her the garden.
Yeah, but
she wants to show her everything she's achieved. She wants her mum to be proud of her.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Not because she doesn't want to talk shop. It's because she doesn't care.
Yeah, I agree.
She doesn't care. And I've got it in my notes here. That whole sequence of them chatting about the displaced Jews the mother worked for, it's treated like gossip. It's like playground gossip. It's not it's not a thing that's like, oh my God, this is so shocking. It's just, oh, well, I bid for their curtains. I didn't get them. What a shame.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Not, oh, my God, these people were dragged out.
Curtains.
Yeah, exactly.
She talks more about the curtains than she does the family that own them.
You know, what they're talking about, what they're talking about to them isn't important for the right reasons. It's this thing of, it shows the subtleties, and it shows the to some anyway, not everyone, but the all-encompassing nature of the final solution to some, and the way the Nazi party got their claws into people. And obviously, you know, it's going to be different for Hedwig because she's married to Rudolf Hess. She's very close with him. They talk a lot. You see him talk in bed about things.
Yeah.
So she is fully aware where she is.
Oh yeah.
And all the way through the movie, you're kind of, is the way it's presented to me, or the way I see it at least, you're not sure if she fully buys into it. You're not sure whether she cares about the house, about the family, or about everything. And there's a moment where me and Matt, we turn to each other and we just said the word complicit. Because there's a sequence where one of the help, who is Jewish girl, has done something wrong or something, very minor thing.
So her mother leaves.
That's it.
And she sets a place for her breakfast. And she says, have you done this to embarrass me? And then she says what she says, which I think you're going to mention now.
And she's clearly annoyed that her mum's left. Her mum's left a note, because at night you see sequences of the mother hearing the furnace is going. over in the camp. And you get this beautiful...
That in itself is an incredibly affecting sequence.
This beautifully staged, framed scene of her standing in the window with the orange glare from the fire, and she's just staring out the window at it.
Yeah.
And she can't sleep.
That whole, before you talk about the next little bit, just to come off that sort of scene, the thing that struck me is there's two little girls, her granddaughters, who are asleep in the bed next to her.
Yeah.
They're used to that sound. They're used to that glow. Well, it's normal. Somewhat used to it.
Yeah.
One little girl is obviously having trouble sleeping and is frequently found sat in places around the house at night. But at that point, they're both asleep. And the mother's, I think at that point, she's been there for maybe two days, a couple of nights.
Two, 3 days at least.
And yeah. And she's struggling to get used to it, whereas everyone else, and the way the film shows this, is it pans to, or it cuts to a couple of different bedrooms and shows everyone else asleep.
Peacefully
asleep.
They're
used to that industrial sound. They're used to that glow. She can't get used to it.
No. And she leaves, and she leaves a letter, and Hedwig finds it, and she reads it. We're not shown it as the audience what it says. Me and Matt have theorised it says, perhaps you're all crazy, you're monsters, or I don't want to be here. Something. It's something annoying. It's something that doesn't sit well with Hedwig. She doesn't like what
she
she's
burns,
read.
She burns the letter. And she burns the letter. That is another very powerful little moment where she takes the letter and she puts it into the fireplace. Yeah. And the parallels between that and what the mother has seen and witnessed and has probably driven her to leave again. It's
a lot of imagery, a lot of metaphors. And then Hedwig, as Matt was saying, the table's set down. Hedwig's annoyed, and she says something. I'm paraphrasing, but she says, "My husband could have your ashes spread all around the fields, and they'd never find you."
Complicit.
And it floored me. And I'm just
it's that moment that you instantly realise that she knows. She knows the extent of what's going on.
She's in on it too.
She's not just this woman that's in a little idyllic house.
No, yeah. And you think that for a little bit, because we've had a sequence with her sleeping, and she has a big argument with him saying, I want my house, you can't leave here. And we think, okay, well, on one level I can understand she doesn't want to pick our family up and move them. I understand that, I get that. But then on this backdrop of what's happening next to the house, it just has
that in itself is super jarring, isn't it? That she wants to live next to a death camp. And because their experience of being in that area, that situation, that it's completely different to the reality of what is really going on.
Yeah. It's so, everything's so cold, everything's so flat and delivered so naturally that it has this extra layer of ickiness and any ill feeling. And I never felt settled when I was watching the movie. And obviously it doesn't want you to feel settled. It wants you to think, it wants you to have these reactions, but it's just very unsettling. And then towards the end of the movie, I think it's the end sequence for me. And I think for everyone who goes to see this movie, this is the sequence that will stick with you. And spoilers, sorry, if you haven't seen the movie, please go and see it. It's an absolute powerhouse of a piece of filmmaking. So Hearst learns that the execution of the Jews of Hungary will be going into effect, and they're going to call it Operation Hearst after him. Mm-hmm. And he'll be moving back from a different role back to Auschwitz to oversee that. He's happy about it, but he's not jumping at it. He's not like visibly.
He's quietly proud.
Proud.
Says to
that's
her on the
it.
Phone, doesn't he? Says I'm pleased as punch. I think
that's
is the tenor phrase he uses on the phone when he calls her.
And he says, "Oh, I'm at this party. They're celebrating." They're either celebrating that or they're just having a party. I didn't know what it was.
The context isn't fully given.
Vague. And Hearst says to Hedwig on the phone, "Oh, well, I couldn't settle at the party. I'd sat in the main ballroom and wondered how much gas it would take to kill everyone." And you're unsure whether he means the people at the party or whether he means the people that he's going to be...
Yeah, the 700,000 Jews from Hungary.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. and it works on both levels, and it's still cold and horrible. And then he puts his hat on, walks down the steps, and he starts to retch as if he's going to be sick, and nothing comes up. Then he stops, walks down another flight of stairs, and the angle changes, and he's doing it again. And he's quite, you can see this is strange to him. Just this retching is coming out of nowhere. And he looks down the barrel of the camera at us, or at the darkness of the corridor. You're not quite sure, but it is at us, the viewer. Then we cut to black again, and you see a tiny dot of light on the screen that gets a little bit bigger, but not very bigger. And there's me thinking in the cinema, oh God, they're finally going to show something. We're finally going to see something. This has got to be inside of a gas chamber. And I'm preparing myself to see these horrific scenes, because we've heard them all the way through the movie. And I'm thinking, oh my word, if this movie can conjure up the imagery that it can conjure up with sound, imagine what it might do if it's going to show it. And the door opens, and it's two cleaners going into a gas chamber to clean it at the museum.
Yeah.
And it is so striking and so hard hitting that, and it takes you through the cleaner's morning routine, and you see the vacuuming, the mopping,
wiping down some of the glass,
cleaning
of
pictures, and then you see the piles of shoes, you see the uniforms they were made to wear, and the personal effects piled up, but with no sound, just the sound of hoovers and people walking around.
It's diegetic sound again, isn't it?
It's
really effective.
And I nearly cried. I was so close to tears. And then you think, okay, that's going to be the film. That's it now. You've shown everything you can show. But no, we cut back to Huss, and it's the same shot of him looking down the barrel of the camera again for maybe a split second. Then he turns away and walks down the steps, and he fades black, and we get that soundscape again. And for me, it's this allegory of we can't stop what he's done, but we can stop our movie to show you the effects of what he's done and why he's such a horrible, risible human being who quite rightfully was found guilty of his crimes and killed, you know, and you know, put to death. And it's such a different way of tackling this subject matter, which, you know, must 100% be continued to be shown and reminded of, because I think sometimes at the moment, the way the world is, I think we need a bit of grim reality sometimes to ground us.
I thought the everyday aspect of them going about their, you know, business, cleaning the exhibits and cleaning the actual you know, gas chamber itself, was very well mirrored with the mundane everyday stuff that the family were doing in their home.
100%.
I thought that was very effective as well. The film, as you've already said, Rob, goes to great lengths not to show the actual horrors.
No.
You know, and it is more tell, not show. And I think that illustrates the horrific daily reality, you know, the small, mundane detail.
Yeah.
I think the juxtaposition of that against the massive industrial scale of subjugation and murder is very powerful. I mean, we get kind of little hints as the film evolves. We get the smoke of the train passing, the camp prisoners working in their garden.
You see them, you see a
soldiers
few...
passing,
yeah.
The discussion of the cremation chamber and the new design that they're working
on. Like these
on.
Guys
and
coming to
so proud of
effectively
it.
Sell it to him.
Yeah, they're like showing him the thing and they explain it, and you can tell he doesn't immediately understand what they're explaining, and then he says, oh, it keeps working, you can clear out one chamber while the next one's burning, and he's like, great. And then later on he's recording a memo, and he says, we should file a patent to protect that design.
Incredible.
Because of its ingenuity.
It's insane.
I think for me, there's some other nuances and details that go into the film. So there's a bit where the older son, who's in Hitlerjugend attire,
yeah,
in a lot of the scenes he's in, so he's about 13, perhaps 12, 13, he locks his little brother into the greenhouse, and he kind of like frog marches him in and pushes him in. He's like, no, I don't want to go in. He like pushes him into the greenhouse,
and
then starts making hissing sounds. And it just dawned on me, like, his father has taken him to probably, and he's been present
at least once
when people have been pushed into a gas chamber and killed.
Yeah. And you,
because he goes out on like almost daily rides with him, so yeah. I assume his father's like
taking, you know, close him around to him. Once.
He's taking him to show him his job.
Mm.
That bit. Well, that he's bit, in, that in floored me.
I mean, I guess in Hearst's mind, he's the next generation.
Yeah.
And I didn't pick up on that when I first saw it. And we were walking. I remember we were walking down the stairs of the cinema, getting back to the car, and you said, "Oh, that sequence there implies that he's seen it or heard about it or been present." And I was like, wow, yeah, it did. It's incredible. Yeah.
I think, honestly, there's probably a lot of sequences and a lot of small nuances that have been interjected into it that you could easily miss. Like, you and I have a fairly decent appreciation of some of the nuance of the Holocaust. We're not experts, obviously, good God. Like, but we can pick out detail and certain elements of it. Stuff like the clothes. She's trying on a fur coat near the beginning of the film, and she's looking at the lining where it's been cut to check for, you know, hidden money, jewelry, that kind of thing. And she's like, oh, that'll have to be repaired. There's a conversation, isn't there, between a couple of women talking about someone goes to Canada to pick up some clothing, and it's referring to the warehouse.
It's Canada, from Canada. This is from Canada, and the girl thinks it's the country, but no, it's one of the warehouses was called Canada with a K. Like, it's just, there's so much going on here that's so subtle. And
the when the wind changes, there's a Polish family in their flat. You've never seen them before. It's, you know, it's the wind changes, and you see the mother absolutely panic. She runs around shutting all the windows. She's on the balcony trying to pull her clothes off the line, and you can see little flecks of ash flow by.
Yeah, and talking of that sequence, that part of the movie when there's an outside shot of her getting the clothing in, that's shot on a thermal camera. And there's only one other bit in the movie that uses a thermal camera. So if you remember the production part of the episode, I talked about the girl named Alexandra who puts out the apples. So I got a quote from Glazer here about that sequence in particular, because me and Matt weren't sure whether it was a dream sequence, whether it was really happening. Because
when you first see it, you thought it immediately kind of follows a sequence with one of the daughters. He's reading a story.
It
almost feels like it could be the kid's dream. She returns later on, and it's much more in depth.
Clearly not.
Sorry.
So no, it's fine. That makes complete sense. I think it's presented to you in a little bit ambiguous way, and the cut of using the thermal camera is very sort of, it's quite dream sequence like in a way. So anyway, Glazer explains this sequence. He says, "How are you going to see her if you can't use lights? There's no ambient light anywhere near that you could justify. Zal and I talked about how we could see her. Really, it just came down to, what's the only tool exists where we'll be able to see something that our eyes couldn't? That was a thermal camera. Then we went along a very difficult journey into that technology in order to capture this sequence. You're not seeing light recorded here. You're seeing heat recorded. I suppose it's a pretty dramatic shift in imagery from everything that you've seen up to this sequence, but it's presented with the same intention, with the same commitment to the dogma of 21st century tools, 21st century lens, its present tense. The aesthetic follows the fundamentals of it. There's something very beautiful and poetic about the fact it is heat, and she does glow. It reinforces her as an energy."
Yeah. Hair warmth, life, in contrast to the coolness and the dark and the death of the camp that she's spreading the apples around. Mm. And I thought that rings true.
Really does. And I think this week, I think we implore everyone to go and see this movie. If you can, at a cinema.
Oh, God. Yeah, there's a dozen other parts of this film we could talk about. The jaw in the river.
Yeah.
You know, and then him panicking to get the kids back. And
cleaning them out. Cleaning them off, scrubbing them down.
Yeah.
You know, not because they were in a... Even their eyes. Not because they were in a dirty river, but because of what was in that river.
Yeah.
It says a lot more than it needs to, which is horrible and, you know, hope it's never repeated again. So, yeah, in this movie, as me and Matt have said, it's one you should go and see. Please go and try and see it in a cinema.
Without doubt.
Without a doubt.
Incredibly moving piece of film.
Very moving film.
Very powerful cinema.
One of the best films I've definitely seen in a long, long while. And, you know, his subject matter is so important. And to present it in a very different way than what we're used to is just... Mm. I want to use the word refreshing, but that's not right. It's just so different that it is worth seeing. And I've got my closing thoughts here are it's a film with no plot, quote unquote. It's a slice of life. It's about nothing, but it's about everything, if that makes sense. It's what we choose to see, what we choose to ignore. It's a very hard thing to pin down, but I think Glazer gets it.
Yeah.
And that is my ending thoughts this week on this movie, Zone of Interest.
I would just reiterate that if you're listening to this and you haven't seen it, I would definitely go and try and see it in cinemas because you will get the most impact from it. Mm. I think it will carry through on TV at home, on streaming perhaps. But I think to get the full effect of the film and the filmmaking that's gone into it, it's best seen in cinemas.
Agreed.
To get the full weight of the film.
Yep. So that was our review of Zone of Interest. I hope you enjoyed listening. A very different episode than what we're used to doing. We hope we tackled it with the right amount of weight that it deserves. And yep, say again, please go and see it if you can, and do join us again next time for more Fighting on Film. See you next time, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.